From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're exploring a group of bills making its way through the legislature that would force the federal government to turn some 30 million acres of public land back over to the state. Many of the lawmakers who support the bills know their prospects are iffy. Cedar City Representative Evan Vickers said he figured it would take the Supreme Court less time to throw the legislation out than it took to debate it. But he told his colleagues, we have to keep trying. Legislators are hoping to give private developers access to what they say is trillions of dollars in oil and gas and coal on federal land. Critics say the effort is frivolous political pandering that could cost taxpayers millions in legal fees. We're profiling the legislation today. We'll explore the legal and political dimensions of the bills, not to mention their environmental implications. After the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Last week, the Utah House passed a group of bills that could force a legal confrontation with the federal government over public land. The bills are on their way to the Senate. They're expected to pass there. They would transfer some 30 million acres of federal land to Utah. It means millions of acres protected as potential wilderness. The idea is to free up the oil and gas and coal reserves in the state. Critics call it political pandering. They say the legislation doesn't have a chance in court. We're talking about the bill today, evaluating its legal chances and the environmental implications, and we invite you to join the conversation. 801-585-WEST is the number, 801-585-9378, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Joining us in the studio is Dan Baumas, a host, of course, of Morning Edition, a reporter for KUER. His story on the session's public land transfer bills ran this morning on KUER. And Dan, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much.
Robert Gerke is joining us. He's a government reporter for the Salt Lake Tribune. He's been covering the legislature and this particular issue, and he's joining us from Capitol Hill. And Robert Gerke, welcome to you. Thanks for being with us.
Hi, Doug. Thanks.
Well, let's start with what the bill does. Robert Gerke, I guess with you, it sort of challenges the right of the federal government to own and manage land in Utah. That's the sort of essence of it.
Yeah, that's sort of at the core. I mean, it's a package of bills that are kind of moving in conjunction with each other and work in conjunction with each other. And it would ask initially the federal government to surrender the rights to these lands, and failing that, there are steps that would be taken to sort of force their hand, I guess, in that regard.
We're talking 30 million acres. Put that in perspective. What proportion? Is that all the federal land in the state?
Well, it's not quite all of the federal land in the state. I mean, it doesn't. The bill doesn't touch on military installations, American Indian lands. There's a provision in there that says national parks would be turned over to the state, and then the state would give them back with whatever conditions it decides are appropriate on the use of the land. But it is about 60% of the land mass in the state, and it would be under the control of this Public Lands Commission to sort of set the use of those acres.
So Dan, the state takes the land back, or the federal government surrenders it anyway. And the state does what with it? It makes some policy changes, uses it for energy development, then gives it back? I mean, how does it work?
Well, it gives the national parks back. That's what's agreed
to. But not the other lands.
Lands would be available for multiple use is the catchphrase that everyone uses. But for energy development, for whatever the state chooses to do with them, essentially. And the state of Utah is arguing in these bills that the federal government is required to do this under the terms of the Enabling Act, that is Utah's legal authority to become a state. It was passed in 1894 and was the basis of Utah's state constitution. And there's a section in the Enabling Act that the backers of this legislation interpret to mean that the federal government has made this commitment at the time Utah became a state to either liquidate these lands or to hand them over.
So in other words, if they can't think of something to do with the lands, then it goes back to the states. That's the idea.
Well, more than that, they simply agreed to do it for whatever purpose. There was not a condition, as the backers of this legislation see it. They said the federal government is required to turn over these lands as a condition of Utah's statehood.
I want to go back to that legal question in just a moment, because that, I think that's interesting or significant. But it does raise the question, and Robert Gerke, maybe put this in context for us in terms of the state's history, because you could see this as just another battle in this ongoing war that some lawmakers have with the federal government, which – and you've said in your piece, Robert Gerke, that these are the kind of battles that are kind of part of the state's DNA. We do this all the time, I guess.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the bill itself and the philosophy behind the bill itself is almost identical to the philosophy that drove the Sagebrush Rebellion about 30 years ago in 1979. You had Nevada pass a law that says that sort of declared federal holdings in that state null, and Utah followed suit the next year. And their intention, Nevada's intention, was to try to get this issue in front of a court. They hired Rex Lee, who was Mike Lee's father, and and had him do legal work to kind of explore the possibility of getting this to court. But the court battle never came, and after the Reagan election in 1980, there was the issue kind of died down a little bit. You see it come and go, obviously, and it seems to flare up when there's when there are Democrats in the White House and there are additional restrictions on oil and gas drilling. And you know, but it still is rooted in this argument that 116 years ago, when Utah got statehood, that the feds would liquidate this land or not liquidate, but transfer this land to the state. And they've done it in other states, the proponents argue, but they haven't done it in Utah and Nevada and some of the other Mountain West states.
So what's different, do you think, this time? I mean, what has changed? And how significant is it? I mean, I think it's interesting because you're hearing a lot of people in our conversations with some of the – in the environmental community. I mean, they're outraged at the, you know, the notion, that the idea –
yeah.
But don't seem terribly concerned that it could really hold up in court, so they don't seem all that worried just yet.
Yeah, well, I think what is a little different this time is that in the you know, in 79 and 80, it was mostly ranchers and rurals who were pushing this. This time, it seems to be prompted a little bit more by oil and gas exploration, the desire to do that, and coal as well. You also, in the intervening years, you had the Grand Staircase that was created, and that's still an issue that causes a lot of consternation among some of the rural Utahns and coal developers. So I think you've got – it seems to be a little bit more tense this time, or a little bit more pointed. I mean, I wasn't there originally when they passed this in 1980, but from my reading on the issue. You know, and so I think there's some of that. There obviously are differing legal opinions, but there seems to be a broad school of thought that both from the legislative attorneys and legal experts and others that this doesn't really have much of a chance of prevailing, and a concession, I guess, among some of the legislators who are supporting it, that it doesn't as well.
Although I think there is a determination to get into court if they can.
You think that's the goal?
Yeah, because nothing will happen with this unless and until the state of Utah gets some kind of a judgment from a federal court saying this has to happen.
Let me bring another voice into the conversation to give some sort of more legal perspective. Bob Keiter is with us, a professor in the College of Law at the University of Utah. He teaches constitutional and natural resources law. We should also say he directs the Wallace Stegner Center at the university. And Professor, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Doug.
Non-starter? People are sort of dismissing it. It doesn't have much of a chance. Is there any sort of legal strategy that could work in some way? How are you assessing it?
Well, one historical fact to note, the legal theory being advanced here is a little bit different than the one underlying the Sagebrush Rebellion theory, which was predicated upon an equal footing doctrine argument that Nevada and other Western states were advancing at that point in time. In this instance, as has already been noted, the proponents of this legislation are relying upon the Utah Enabling Act, a specific section that has a rather general reference reference to the federal government disposing of lands found within the boundaries of the state of Utah. That provision is counterbalanced by two other provisions in the Utah enabling legislation, both of which say that the state expressly disclaims any interest to or claim on the federal lands found within the state's boundaries. There's a similar provision, I might note, within the Utah state constitution. So in terms of the Utah-related legislation, this would be a pretty tough argument to get over. Those other provisions relying upon this general reference to disposal.
Is it clear? I mean, the Enabling Act, is the language clear enough to make it – I mean, legal advisors to the legislature have expressed their concerns, of course. Does it seem pretty obvious, pretty clear to you? I mean, what do you make of the strategy around it?
Well, in addition to the language found in the Utah legislation, ultimately the authority over the federal lands is vested in Congress under Article 4 of the United States Constitution, a provision known as the Property Clause. The Supreme Court, in a number of different decisions over the years, has basically said that Congress's authority over public lands is without limitations, is at least some of the language found there. It's also gone on to say that Congress can act both as a sovereign and a proprietor with respect to these lands, all of which has led both the lower courts and commentators to conclude that Congress is entitled basically to change its mind. And that's essentially what has happened over time with respect to its management of the public lands, where it initially provided back at the turn of the 19th into the 20th century to dispose of these lands, principally through homesteading laws, mining laws, and that sort of thing. Eventually, throughout the 11 western states, there weren't takers for most of the arid lands found here, and Congress eventually changed its mind and decided that it would hold on to these lands and manage them actively. Interestingly enough, under the multiple use principle that's being proposed in the legislation that we're talking about.
So that's been decided. The federal government said, we do have an intention for this land, and we're going to keep it.
That's correct. Early on, even before Utah became a state, the federal government made clear that it was going to keep some of the federal lands in federal control. That was manifest both through some of the early national park designations as well as the authority given to the president in 1891 to create forest reserves. There's a set of Supreme Court decisions challenging the authority of the federal government to retain and reserve forest reserves. The court unanimously held that the federal government had that authority back again early in the 20th century. And essentially what has happened over time is that the federal government decided to do basically the same thing with what we now know as the BLM public lands and is retaining those under legislation known as the Federal Land Policy and Management Act, or FLPMA.
Yeah. Dan Bomas, what how are law? I mean, they know this. Lawmakers, they've heard the arguments. How are they responding, and what's their way around it as you talk to them?
I think it's that these issues really haven't been litigated on this basis in the past. There have been, again, with the Sagebrush Rebellion and other challenges, you know, there's a theory that the state of Utah could take over some of this land by eminent domain, and that's a separate issue.
Yeah.
I think the question that's still open is, does this argument actually apply? And they're hoping that they can get a federal court to rule on that question.
Professor Guider, what's the sort of atmosphere like, do you think, right now in terms of whether or not they could get a hearing like that, they could get a response like that from a federal judge?
Well,
or for that matter, a Supreme Court. The Supreme
sure.
Court.
Certainly, the state could take the case into the federal courts. Federal courts would be obliged to rule on it. There'd be a number of procedural hurdles to get over, the amount of time that's lapsed since the Enabling Act was passed would be one of them. But assuming those
116 years, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Assuming those issues could be surmounted, a court, assuming it followed precedent, would most likely rule in favor of the federal government. And then the question would be whether the Supreme Court would be willing to grant certiorari, which is an entirely discretionary decision. Probably worth noting that there are a couple of cases that have been before the Supreme Court in recent years raising questions about state school trust lands. In each instance, the court well, maybe I should separate them out. In the case in a Montana case that was just decided by the Supreme Court, where the state was arguing that it could reclaim lands that were in federal control in order to support the state school trust fund, the court ruled unanimously against the state. The issue was different, but underlying this was a claim of state sovereign control over some submerged lands that the court ultimately concluded were non-navigable. And I should say that that ruling overturned a decision of the Montana Supreme Court that had supported the state's argument. And the U.S. Supreme Court ruling was unanimous in that case.
Robert Gerke, what is next for this? I mean, I think most people figure they'll pass in the Senate. What's the governor talking about? I mean, ultimately, this calls upon Congress to act.
Yeah.
Does that mean that one of the Utah congressional delegation or any number of them have to take it up? What does it mean next?
Well, that's an interesting question. I mean, procedurally, yeah, it's sitting in the Senate now, and it will presumably go to the governor's desk, and the governor's expressed support for it, including the litigation. There have been encouragement, according to the sponsors, from Senator Lee and Representative Bishop to pass these because they think it helps draw attention to the issue and give some leverage to them in dealing with Congress, although it's a tough lift in that regard as well. You've got, there are timelines, deadlines set up for the federal government to declare its intentions and to make the transfers required under the bill. And failing that, then there's other actions that the Public Lands Commission would be taking to start planning on how to use these lands. And so that's sort of where it goes from here. The goal, again, is to, you know, to get this in front of court, in front of a judge and into court. And they're hoping that they can get the federal government to sue the state rather than the state having to sue the federal government over it for procedural purposes. Again, we're talking about the 30 million acres. We're talking about dissolving the Grand Staircase. There's several million acres of wilderness study areas, and then the national parks issue that there's some disagreement over. But again, it gives the state the control over how to use those. So again, if it does go to Congress, that becomes an interesting argument that the members of the delegation are going to have to be making.
Dan Bomas, this is playing out in an election year. Is that adding another dimension?
It certainly does. I mean, these issues do come up every session, though. But it was in this year that a group of legislators came into the session with a plan. And this wasn't just individuals acting. This was a group, including Representative Barris, who is the chair of the relevant committee, and Representative Ivory, who's been championing these kinds of issues through his service in the legislature. And so you can say that, yes, the people sponsoring these would like to get noticed and recognized for their challenge to the federal government. But I think there's really a core set of beliefs that the federal government really ought not to impose its will on the states and ought to free up this land to give the western states an opportunity to have more control over their own destiny. So it's an intellectual, ideological issue. I mean, Representative Bishop has been kind of an intellectual godfather of this with something called the Apple Initiative that goes back to 2006. So and there are lots and lots of previous attempts. I cited one in my story this morning where Governor William Spry in 1915 was pointing out some of these issues.
Yeah. So this has
been around a while.
Been around a while. Professor, final question. How much would something like this cost to litigate?
That's probably difficult to determine, but certainly it would take a number of years to work its way up through the courts. Cost would probably depend upon whether the state decided to retain private counsel to handle this matter or whether it handled it internally. In any event, a number of hours that a lawyer would put into initial trial of the case and then an appeal would be certainly in the hundreds, if not even higher than that. And, Doug, I might add that certainly I think everyone's sympathetic with the plight of both the state trying to derive revenue from these scattered school trust lands that were ceded to the state at the time of statehood, and at the same time with the frustrations and difficulties that the federal land managers confront with these scattered land holdings. One of the ways that might be productive to try to approach this problem is through strategic land exchanges that address a variety of different interests in an attempt to cut a political deal that would satisfy the state in terms of revenue, federal land managers in terms of managerial efficiency. The state would be interested in that too.
And you're saying it's a more that's a more practical approach.
A more practical approach. Communities would be interested both in terms of potential economic development opportunities, road decisions, that sort of things, and environmental interests, of course, would be concerned about some of the preservation wilderness questions. And if you can tie that up in a negotiated package, these types of exchanges have been done elsewhere and could potentially be done here.
It's Bob Keiter. He's a professor in the College of Law at the University of Utah, and he's the Wallace Stegner Professor of Law at the University. Thanks very much, Professor, for being with us.
My pleasure.
Robert Gerke covers the legislature for the Salt Lake Tribune. Robert, thanks very much.
Thank you, Doug.
And Dan Baumus, host and reporter for KUER. Dan, stay with us, if you will. 801-585-WEST, the number to join us. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We'll take a break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're exploring an effort by Utah lawmakers to force the federal government to hand over public land back to the state. A suite of bills making its way through the legislature that would transfer some 30 million acres of federal land to Utah. We invite you to join us. 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We're talking about the legislation today. Joining us now is Republican Ken Ivory. He represents West Jordan's District 47 in the Utah House of Representatives. He's a sponsor of the central bill dealing with public lands this session, and he's joining us from the Capitol. And Representative Ivory, sorry for the wait. Welcome. Thanks for being with us.
No, thank you. It's just it's a busy time. There's a lot of balls in the air.
Well, thanks for the time. Let me ask first, as you know, lawmakers have been fighting this fight for decades now. Could I ask, what was the trigger for you to raise the subject again?
Well, yeah, there's a couple of big triggers. Number one, we have a $2.2 billion funding gap in per pupil funding to the national average. We're $2.2 billion below the national average in per pupil funding. We have $5 billion of our state revenue that is wholly dependent on a federal government that Erskine Bowles and David Walker and Ben Bernanke and even President Obama himself says is completely unsustainable. And so we've got a problem. We've got a big issue to deal with going forward. And these aren't things that are susceptible to easy solutions. And then a couple of years ago, there's a unanimous Supreme Court decision dealing with the Lands and the Enabling Act in the state of Hawaii. And the Supreme Court unanimously held that the consequences of a state's admission are instantaneous. It ignores the uniquely sovereign character of that event to even suggest that subsequent acts of Congress can somehow diminish what was already bestowed at statehood. And then they said this applies with even greater force and effect where virtually all of a state's public lands are at stake. And so what they said, this Supreme Court unanimously said that Congress can't change the vested rights of a state's Enabling Act. Well, that being the case, in our Enabling Act, the same as the Enabling Acts of all the states east of Colorado, the federal government promised to dispose of the public lands. Now, with all of the states east of Colorado, and in fact with the western states as well, with all of the states east of Colorado, it honored that promise. And so take North Dakota, for example. They were already at the average in per pupil funding. they're now $2.2 billion ahead of that. They added another $3,700 per pupil. And so we're $4.4 billion behind North Dakota. And the terms of their Enabling Act with respect to disposing of the public lands are word for word identical, virtually identical to those of Utah. So we're simply looking for the federal government to honor this promise that it made going back to 1780, to the Land Ordinance of 1785, the Northwest Ordinance of 1787, Article 4 of the Constitution, all the Supreme Court cases up to the very time of our Enabling Act and beyond. So
you see a way in here. I mean, others have said, look, there's no chance, and this has been ruled on before. There's precedent. There's an enabling clause. It states that the people inhabiting this state do affirm and declare that they forever disclaim all right and title to the unappropriated public lands lying within the boundaries thereof. I mean,
Wait. Now, don't stop reading there.
Well, I don't have the right.
The next sentence after that says, until the federal government shall have extinguished title to the lands, they shall be subject to the disposition of the federal government.
Okay.
And in fact, that was dealt with in the very Gibson case that is in the constitutional note to this bill. Where that quotes the language from the Northwest Ordinance that says a provision has been inserted in the compacts, the enabling acts, of the new states that are admitted to the Union, that they wouldn't interfere with the primary disposal duty of the federal government. And that specific provision, it says, was to secure title to the bona fide purchasers when the federal government disposes of the land. So you can't stop there.
So you sound pretty confident that you have a legal chance here.
Well, sure. I'm sorry. Tell me your first name again. I'm sorry.
Sorry, it's Doug.
Doug. So, Doug, all the way up to 1976, the federal government never disputed. No one disputed that the federal government had to dispose of the land. 1915, our Senate did a resolution and said, "Hey, wait a second, you're not acting the way you acted when we were made a state, and we're calling on you to do a speedy return to the formal liberal national attitude toward the public domain, to dispose of the land, because we only have 1/3 of our land is subject to tax. We've got to provide services to 100% of the state." So then you go forward to 1932. There was a presidential commission and then Senate hearings on the disposal of the public lands to the states, and no one disputed in that, in the commission's granting the remaining unreserved public lands to the states, no one disputed that the land needed to go to the states. They just disputed how to do it. Well, that led to the Taylor Grazing Act in 1934, which led to the BLM, which said this is just a management act pending final disposal of the lands. Until you get to 1976 with the Federal Land Policy Management Act, and then they say after a 200-year history of the federal government duty, in fact they called it a trust duty, a solemn obligation to dispose of the lands, in 1976 they finally say in FLTMA, we're now going to retain the lands under federal control.
But that was pretty clear. I mean, the language was pretty clear.
In FLTMA, you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah, but so then that goes to the Hawaii case. That speaks right to the heart of the Hawaii case. The Hawaii case, the Supreme Court unanimously says, Congress on its own cannot change the vested rights of a state's enabling act.
Let me ask you. Sounds like you're prepared to sort of push this through. And I wanted to ask you, how much money do you figure the state could make off of these lands? I mean, supporters say, I've heard as figures as much as $3 trillion could come from Utah and coal reserves.
Well, I mean that. Those are some figures on what I understand to be the net value, or rather the value of what they estimate some of the reserves to be. But let's take the low-hanging fruit, just the Sitla lands, just the lands that were expressly granted to the state for education, which was done with all the other states east and west of Colorado. Because the federal government has surrounded them, they're landlocked, and then they've cut off the RS-2477 roads to the Sitla lands. Kevin Carter, the director of Sitla, estimates we're losing hundreds of millions of dollars on the lands that were already granted to us. So that's an easy one, low-hanging fruit right there. But then you look at the loss in taxation, the loss in severance tax revenues, on the severance taxes and on the mineral monies, all the states east of Colorado, they keep 100%. Utah gets, the federal government takes a management fee off the top, and then we get 46% after that. So North Dakota has the exact same, virtually word-for-word identical terms in their Enabling Act. They keep 100% of the revenues. They control their lands and resources. They have 11.6 pupils per teacher in their classroom. They added a $1.2 billion directly to school buildings and road infrastructure this year, in addition to increasing per-pupil funding by $3,700 a student, because they have access to their lands and their resources. And so, Doug, where the promises are the same, why is the performance different? That's the question.
How much money do you figure this is going to cost to taxpayers? As I understand it, you're trying to get some – is it $6 million for ongoing litigation?
No, and in fact, it doesn't have to do with litigation. The separate severance tax bill that I have has to do with the whole host of actions. I don't know if you're familiar with, just a couple of weeks ago, the federal government just unilaterally took 40% of the nation's uranium reserves off the table. No communication, cooperation, coordination with the states. They've just announced that they're going to take 2 million acres of already designated energy-producing lands off the table. Again, no communication, cooperation, coordination with the states. So there's a whole host of things that we're probably only defending about one of 30 actions that the federal government's taking that deprive our right and control of property in the state of Utah. So that is a separate bill from this. They don't go together. And then this is not a litigation bill. Now, there are other representatives
that are running litigation bills.
What this does is sets a deadline so that in that interim, we want to work with our governing partner. You know, in our governing system, the federal government and the states are to be governing partners in a governing partnership. Well, we set a deadline. They've taken 116 years and have not fulfilled their promise. So as the Hawaii case says, the uniquely sovereign character of a state's admission, well, we're standing up as a sovereign partner and saying, hey, wait a second, guys, it's time to have a partnership discussion here. You've got a deadline on this. We want nothing more than to work out this transfer between and among us in an orderly fashion. But we simply can't wait. With a $2 billion gap to average and per-pupil funding and $5 billion at risk in federal funds that we're dependent upon, and the federal government's broke. They're overspending by $1 trillion a year.
Let me ask you this finally, Representative. Sounds like you're in it for the long haul. One of your colleagues, Mike Noel of CNAB, was quoted as saying he didn't think the chances of the bill passing was terribly high, but he said to win the battle, it's going to take a long time. Do you figure he's right? I mean, how are you measuring your prospects right now?
Well, in any situation when someone is retaining control of the property, you have a high burden to change the status quo. And so certainly there's a high burden. We have to deal with people that, and forgive me, but people that read that first sentence of the Enabling Act and stop there and say, hey, you forever disclaim title, and they don't read the next sentence. And so you have to understand the history, and you have to understand these rights. Well, that takes an investment in learning what the Enabling Act was, what the history was, what they meant at the time, why our Senate in 1915 said, hey, wait a second, why did you change the game? Why did Congress in 1932, when they held presidential commissions and congressional hearings, not even question that the federal government had to dispose of the land? Why in the Taylor Grazing Act did they say, we're just going to manage pending the disposal? And then looking at the things going forward, looking at the comparison of the North Dakota, South Dakota, and other enabling acts of states east of Colorado, comparing them to ours and saying, hey, wait a minute. If the promises are the same, why are you treating us differently? And so, yeah, it's going to take some education, no doubt about it. It's going to take some education because we have a federal government that has, as governments do, I mean, it's the nature of government to amass as much power as you can. They've exerted power over these lands, and now it's become kind of institutionalized. And so, yeah, we need to change that status quo.
That's Ken Ivory. He's the Republican who represents West Jordan's District 47 in the Utah House, joined us from the Capitol. Representative, thanks for the time.
Sure. Thank you very much.
801-585-WEST, the number to join the conversation. We'll get to your phone calls in just a moment. Let's bring another voice in the conversation. John Swallow is joining us, Chief Deputy Attorney General for the state of Utah. His office would be responsible for defending these bills, should they be challenged. And he's in Washington, D.C., joining us by phone from there. John Swallow, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Well, thank you. And this discussion is a great discussion. And this kind of a project is not for the faint of heart.
What do you mean by that?
Well, certainly, when you talk about the fact that these lands have been deeded to the federal government, have been managed by them for the last 116 years, and when you talk about unwinding that situation in the light of federal statutes that are in play right now that are supported under the principles of the Property Clause and the Supremacy Clause, it's always an uphill battle when you go after that type of a remedy that we're looking for, and it's not a battle for the faint of heart.
I know you're obligated to defend the legislation. Sounds like you're committed to it. You agree with it. You think it's a prudent group of bills?
Well, I want to say that we have worked hand in glove, I guess is a better phrase, with legislators on this concept for the last several months. And I understand what the professor was saying about the strength of the property clause and the power of Congress to enact legislation that trumps or supersedes state laws to the contrary under the property clause of the Constitution, under the supremacy clause. We get all of that. Mm-hmm. But what we're really talking about here is a promise or a bargain or a covenant or a contract that has been described as such in recent Supreme Court cases. One case is a Utah case, Utah versus Andrus, a 1980 case that really dealt with our Enabling Act here in the state of Utah. I don't know if you're aware of that, and I'm not sure the professor talked about that case. I don't remember. I mean, I didn't listen to him. I'm here in D.C. But that case, in that case, the Supreme Court was looking at the issue of another portion of the Enabling Act where the federal government was actually deeding lands that are now held by CITLA to the state of Utah, and the question became, one of which of those lands were appropriately given to the state, and when they tried to give us other lands instead, were they substantially similar? But in the case, the Supreme Court acknowledged that the Enabling Act is a lot like a contract between private parties, and that the state deserved the benefit of the bargain that it made at the time of statehood, and that the federal government couldn't ignore the benefit of that bargain. When you fast forward 30 years to the Hawaii versus Office of Hawaiian Affairs case, the 2009 case that Representative Ivory was referencing, you realize that once again the Supreme Court, and that was an issue where at statehood Hawaii actually received title to public to previously owned lands. I think they were owned by the federal government at the time of statehood. Hawaii received those lands. And then Congress tried to change the deal later on and cloud the title and give someone else an interest in those lands. And the Supreme Court unanimously said that the solemn compact or covenant or agreement made at statehood cannot be messed with by Congress subsequent to statehood, that it was relied upon by the sovereign state at statehood, and that subsequent acts of Congress cannot diminish the rights they received under the Enabling Act legislation. And so that's really the theory we're looking at here in terms of the legal side. I mean, we talk about the emotional side. We talk about, you know, what our rights are, and which is really important. We talk about what revenues we're missing because our school children are very important. We have a constitutional duty under our state constitution to educate our children, and that's all important. But the legal theory that we're looking at very aggressively right now is this agreement issue, whether or not a solemn compact was made with the state of Utah, and it was, and whether or not the federal government, by changing the terms midstream, has somehow violated its duty under the contract with Utah to not do that, and whether Utah has a remedy for that violation. That is an issue that was not considered by the Kleppe case, that was not considered by FLIPMA and by courts under FLIPMA. It's kind of a novel theory that, as we've done our research, we haven't seen any precedent that would, besides what I've just cited in the Andrus case and the Hawaii case, that would go contrary to our theory that's a plausible argument for us to make. And the damages that we're receiving by their changing the policy after they did the deal with us are astronomical. So is it a difficult case? Yes. Is it a case that you don't take unwittingly or unknowingly, take casually? No, it's a very serious case. But it's a case we're researching very thoroughly, and we do believe that we've got a great case to make, that we did have a bargain, they didn't keep honor the terms of the bargain, and that we are looking for the remedy, whether the remedy will come through breach of contract or whether it will come in an equitable consideration by the court. Utah has been damaged by the change of policy, and we have the right to assert that claim. And that's what we're looking at.
Final question.
Sure.
Let's say you're a private attorney practicing, uh-huh, and you have a client who doesn't have a lot of money, so it's not inexhaustible resources, and they come to you with this same kind of equation, that you have I won't call it exotic, but you certainly have a novel strategy, a way around it. You've got some precedent that is facing you that's difficult to overcome, and you have to make the decision about whether it's worth it to spend the money How are you thinking about that in this context? Would you say let's go for it?
In light of the two Supreme Court cases I just cited, which recognize the fact that a state and a federal government, when they enter into this agreement, and you're talking about a sovereign state and you're talking about a sovereign federal government entering into this agreement that's relied upon by a state, that's a real issue that needs to be addressed. I tell you, from a personal standpoint on this, I really feel like Utah has been wronged, especially as I look at North Dakota and the flush financial condition they're in terms of their ability to educate their children and create jobs and stimulate an economy, and where Utah is, where we can't even access, on a tax basis, two-thirds of the territorial land within our borders. What would I tell a client like that?
Yeah.
I would say you have to decide whether the benefit from this is worth the expenditure. And so you look at the benefit and say, well, there are potentially billions of dollars and maybe even tens of billions or hundreds of billions of dollars that are at issue here. We see a government right now that's really clamping down on our ability to even access the natural resources that we've developed in the last decade. You know, you talk about the major decision on oil shale just a few weeks ago where they've taken two-thirds of the oil shale capabilities off the table, the uranium decision, the wildlands order that was issued just a year ago that we're fighting now in court. We see these very egregious accelerations of federal power right now, and I ask myself, as a citizen of the state, what have we got to lose? Now, the cost, there will be cost to this, but we have attorneys already working on these things. It may cost us another attorney or two for a few years to do this, but when you talk about the relative cost and the relative benefit for this theory, and when you talk about the ability to manage your lands, and enforce the terms of an agreement, a solemn compact made between the federal government and the state. And by the way, we are not without the resources to fight the battle if we need to do it. I would just say, to this client, this hypothetical client of mine, if the issue is important to you, and you can afford to do it, this is a theory backed by recent Supreme Court decisions that we believe we can make in good faith. And by the way, we don't have to make this decision today. We're going to really research and study this over the next year, develop our theories, and make that decision as we go down the road. Today, the bills are, you know, we're going to study this issue. We're going to study how we create a public lands commission. We're going to get everything ready, which I really like about this legislation. And Representative Ivory ought to be complimented for how he's handled this. And the other Representative Sumption, Representative Herod, and Representative Roger Barris, Representative Mike Noel, all of these representatives have spent a lot of time and energy on these issues and put a lot of thought into these things. They had to be complimented that they are thinking outside of the box, and they have fresh ideas, and they're concerned with where we are going with our public land policies and how we are handicapped in our ability to fund education, which is a primary responsibility under our state constitution for this state. So I compliment them. We're ready for the fight. We're going to do the research. And we know it's, like I said before, not a fight for the faint of heart, but it's an important fight. And I really think we've been wronged. And we're going to try to find a way to remedy that wrong.
It's John Swallow, Utah's Chief Deputy Attorney General, speaking to us from Washington, D.C. Mr. Swallow, thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thanks for your time and interest.
801-585-WEST, the number to join the conversation. We're running behind. I'll try to get to your phone calls, but we need to sort of make an assessment of the environmental implications as well when we get back from a break. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we are talking about a group of bills that passed the House last week, on their way to passing the Senate, transfer some 30 million acres of federal land to Utah. We're talking about that bill. 801-585-WEST, the number to join us. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Joining us now is Tim Wagner. He's with the National Environmental Group, the Sierra Club. His work focuses on public land issues in the greater Colorado Plateau and the Grand Canyon region. He's based here in Salt Lake City. He's joining us in the studio. Tim Wagner, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks, Doug. Happy to be here.
Well, gosh, I guess we could spend some time talking about the legal chances of this, and I do want to get to that. But I wanted to raise – let's put that aside for a minute and say something like this were to pass. I'm not sure. What would the environmental implications be of such a bill? I mean, supporters say they'll give developers access to all of these natural resources. Are you even at the point of thinking about that or worrying about that just yet?
To a degree, yes. I mean, I think obviously, there's a lot of solid questions from the legal standpoint about this issue. But from an environmental perspective, public lands perspective, I think it should concern a lot of people for a variety of reasons. You know, first of all, Utah is defined in a big, big way by our public lands across the state. BLM lands, Forest Service lands, Park Service lands. These are major reasons why so many Utahns choose to stay here, choose to live here, choose to work here. This is our identity. And when you're talking about suddenly transferring 30 million acres of those public lands over to another entity, and I don't believe it would be the state of Utah, it would be in private hands, that's a whole other issue. And when we hear the rhetoric about, you know, such as wilderness or preservation of lands, locking them up, that's rhetoric that obviously we can see through. But when we're talking about turning over 30 million acres of lands to the state of Utah, that would then become private lands, no doubt about it. I mean, this is a state, remember last year, this was the legislature who couldn't find $500,000 to keep open the Cedars edge of the Cedars State Park down in Blanding. And so how are we going to manage 30 million acres of federal lands in the state of Utah? We're not. We can't. We don't have the resources to do that. This is simply an attempt to turn over all these lands to private interest, largely the extractive industries. And let's face the fact, these guys do not have the best interests when it comes to the long-term environmental integrity of these public lands, biodiversity, and so forth. Very big concern, obviously.
Representative Ivory and others say that the federal government is making it – I mean, this is one of the things that seems to have spurred them on, is that the government is making it more difficult to get access to natural resources like oil and gas. Is that factually true? Is it that regulations under the Obama administration are more restrictive for developers?
I don't believe so. No, I don't believe so at all. I think largely that's a lot of rhetoric. Even when we look at the even what was in the Salt Lake Tribune on Sunday when we're talking about oil and gas wells in the state of Utah, we're at a record high, over 10,000 operating oil and gas wells in the state of Utah. That is a record high. So how they can claim that we are being restricted in those endeavors by the Obama administration when, in fact, we've seen no really serious attempts to curtail regulations. We can look at examples like in the state of Colorado where the state has actually enacted some tougher regulations for natural gas development, but it has not curtailed the amount of activity going on. In fact, the state of Colorado is having a natural gas boom just like we are. And they've just made it a little bit tougher to make sure that these companies do the proper procedures to make sure we don't have any spills from fracking fluids and contamination of water and those kind of things. Those are common sense things that should be enacted in any place. And I don't believe the Obama administration is doing any of that. I think a lot of it's just plain hot air, to be quite honest.
I wanted to ask you about the oil, shale, and tar sands argument. I'm sure you heard the speech of Rick Santorum in Michigan where he was mentioning the federal government, you know, keeping developers off of this land in North Dakota, pulls a piece of oil shale or something out of his pocket, and it's sort of to illustrate this idea that the federal government is keeping development from happening on public land. How does that play out in Utah? Utah has oil shale that some say is developable, some say it's not. I mean, what do you make of that argument?
Yeah, that's a very good question, and it's very current because actually the BLM just released a draft environmental impact statement to reassess what the Bush administration had done in 2008 in terms of opening up about 2 million acres for oil shale development.
They cut it back to like 500,000 acres?
Well, they're proposing. Their preferred alternative is back to about 500,000 acres. And basically what the BLM is saying is, look, guys, you've had over a century to try to develop this resource into a viable source of energy to make it profitable, and you still haven't been able to prove it. We're still allowing 500,000 acres to look at this and do research and development. When you get that figured out, come back and talk to us about some more lands for leasing. That's a very reasonable approach. It truly is a reasonable approach. But let's not escape the facts here. What's really going on, and it's the same thing with oil and gas, the industry wants to get as much as they can under lease because those leases act as assets on a profit and loss statement in order to attract investors.
So speculation.
Speculation. That's exactly what it's about. And I've had BLM people tell me that over the years many times, and it's the truth. That's really what's happening here. So are we really concerned about long-term energy sources and making sure we have viable sources of energy, or are we just looking at speculators? I think those are very solid questions that need to be answered.
What do you make of the argument that you're hearing, John Swallow, Ken Ivory making, that, you know, we've got a pretty novel approach now to take this on, and we see a way forward in this enabling clause legislation. There's some precedent that may support us. Some say the precedent is pretty different. But what are you making of that? Does that make you nervous? And what do you think about the prospects that they're talking about?
You know, it makes me nervous on the surface of the fact that we're going to waste a lot of taxpayer dollars in fighting this. And when they try to brand this as a way to help fund public education, let's not let that be an excuse for not providing good and solid funding for our public education. Utah's last per pupil in spending. We know that. They have been for years. What was their reason for this 10 years ago? You know, it really does come down to the fact that we don't have a legislature that takes the best interest of Utahns in heart when it comes to these kind of issues. This is really about trying to put more profit into private industry. And it's not about providing education funding. If they had the will to do it, they would provide the funding. I could provide numerous examples of numerous states here in the West that have a lot of public lands, but yet they still provide, you know, much more per pupil spending than the state of Utah does. Why is that? Because they put a larger emphasis on public education than what our legislature does. And the fact that you know, this is a fight that could take 15, 20 years or more. What does that say for our education needs and for our kids right now? Nothing. It doesn't do anything for those kids. We need funding now. And so, you know, when the state is looking at spending $750,000 to kill coyotes, you know, give that money to the county so they can kill coyotes, but yet we don't have money to further funding for education. I mean, that demonstrates the lunacy behind this kind of stuff. Let's get back to the basics here and legislating for the people and for what the true needs are instead of some pie-in-the-sky dream that most people would say is really that, just a pie-in-the-sky dream.
There's a caller, and I wanted to – a number of you we're not going to be able to get to, and I encourage you to go to our website to join the discussion. But Steve from Salt Lake City was raising this question about, look, do you think that if it doesn't – make, you know, if it confronts a sort of legal obstacle, it doesn't make it, gets thrown out, will that be the end of it? The question being, is this just a message bill? And how is that playing out in the sort of political context? How are you measuring
it? I think it is a message bill. I truly do believe it's a message bill. There's, I mean, you can look at a variety of Western states where they have been sharing these kind of conversations across the political spectrum and, you know, condemning the federal government for this. I mean, it's always the big, bad federal government. But in reality, we take the federal government out of our picture, out of our lives, and suddenly things change dramatically. And not for the better, I do not believe.
It's Tim Wagner with the Sierra Club. Thank you very much.
Thanks,
for joining
Doug.
Us. Dan Bumas, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
Radio West, a production of KUER News. Thanks to Olivia Davis and Matthew Martin. We have technical direction from Mike Anderson, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. Like I said, go to our website. You can continue the discussion, KUER.org/Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio.